Surprised me, only put one bill in the schedule. Move this. We're going to do this more often, I guess. You know, had four bills in the schedule last week, and nobody showed up. Because of the extended testimony that we're expecting and anticipating on this issue, this bill specifically today, we are scheduled to go until 6 o'clock tonight. We will make a decision at about 5, depending on how many more people want to testify, because we are also scheduled for hearing on Friday on this bill. So we may quit at 5 o'clock if we've only got a few people left, or if we're getting through our list, or we may go on to 6:30 or 7, depending on how we're getting through the list and then how many committee members I still have in the room. Anyway, I'm not anticipating limiting anyone's time on testimony. We want to hear all the issues. MLAC, for those of you who know what that means, if you don't, that's called the Management Labor Advisory Committee. They have not taken a position on this bill yet, and we are not going to take any movement on this bill until we at least hear from them on the issue. They are not meeting until next week again, so no action will be taken by this committee on this bill or this workers' comp issue in general until after we get some recommendations from that group. My hope is that we will hear all the issues, the pros and the cons on this bill today and Friday, and we can then bundle up those issues, those concerns, people's advice, people's proposed amendments. If you are going to offer amendments, I hope you have them in written form. So we can then ship that whole packet over to the MLAC committee and let them deal with it as a group. We don't want to, in this committee, be piecemealing the bill if we can avoid it. We'd like MLAC to be able to look at the whole package, and we can make a decision on the package then. That is my goal and what I hope to be able to do in the next week to 6 months, depending how long it takes. With that, Senator Gordley, you would like to welcome some constituents you had here.
I would. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I would just ask that you join me in welcoming constituents from North Northeast Portland. They are here under the auspices of the African American Legislative Issues Roundtable and sponsored by the Scanner News Group, Bernie Foster, publisher, and Mr. Foster is sitting here on the front row. Just very excited that you all are here in the Capitol today, and just remember that the process belongs to you, and you're here on a good day and a great day. The issue in front of us this afternoon is workers' compensation.
Thank you, and welcome to our committee. With that, we'll dive right into it. John Schiltz and Meg Hold, will you come on up and introduce the bill? I think, are there any additions to your analysis? I think the whole committee has that already, so isn't that correct, Mr. Putman? So you can make them available to other people. And go ahead when you're ready, introduce yourselves, and let's get started.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Meg Reinhold. I'm with the Director's Office for Consumer and Business Services Department. Beside me is John Schiltz. He's our Division Administrator for the Workers' Compensation Division. I also serve as the Administrator to the Management Labor Advisory Committee. We're here today to start talking about SB 485. I'm going to talk about how we got here, and John's going to talk about what it actually does. As many of you know, the governor appointed a task force over the interim to look at the workers' compensation system and see if there were some things that people could agree on as we started the session, sort of a large reform bill that's similar to ones we've done in the past. SB 485 is the result of that group. MLAC is now reviewing it. We've taken a lot of testimony. I notice there's a lot of people here that have been to MLAC and are participating in that process, and we certainly appreciate everybody's input and are taking certainly all the suggestions into account. So even though this has had a lot of review, as you know, the governor always appreciates the input of the legislature, and we look forward to going over this bill with you today and answering any questions giving you any advice you might need. John?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, My name is John Schultz. As Meg said, I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, and it's my pleasure to be here today to talk about Senate Bill 485. Before I dive right into the bill, just a couple of remarks. One is I'll try to keep my remarks brief because I know there's a lot of people that want to testify. And two, I just want to give a little bit of an introduction about the workers' compensation system itself. And I think to give some background of why this bill is important. The workers' compensation system here in Oregon has gone through 10 years of significant reform, and we've had a remarkable turnaround in the Oregon workers' compensation system. We had one of the highest cost systems in the nation a decade ago, and frankly, very low benefits being provided to workers. And we have addressed a lot of that here in Oregon. After 10 years of experience with our reform system, unfortunately, we still have some issues that we need to work on, and this bill seeks to address many of those issues. The workers' compensation system needs the support of its constituents in order for it to fulfill its basic mission, which is to provide a compromise that's made between employers and workers that seeks to balance certainty of fair benefits for workers who are injured on the job with the certainty of fair and manageable costs for employers who provide that insurance benefit. This bill seeks to maintain that balance. This bill has several sections that change some of the existing law, and I'm going to touch on each one of those. The first area is in regard to pre-existing condition definition, and it's in section one of the bill. And basically what this does is it changes the definition that exists today in workers' compensation law about pre-existing conditions. The existing definition refers to the term predisposes. That's been struck from the definition. This term was ambiguous. It was difficult to put into practice and has been eliminated by this bill. The bill limits pre-existing injury conditions to only those injuries for which the worker has received treatment or has been diagnosed, with one important exception, which I'll talk about in a minute. So what the group was trying to get to in this particular case was eliminating denials of claims on the basis of pre-existing conditions that had never caused the worker any problems. They'd never been treated, they'd never been diagnosed, the worker was unaware that they even existed. This bill also specifies that pre-existing conditions that for an insurer to deny on the basis of pre-existing condition, the insurer must show that there's a preponderance of evidence that the condition is the major cause of the worker's disability or need for treatment. Section 2 talks about burden of proof. And these two sections combine.
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, back to 1 for just a moment. You add arthritis or arthritic condition, line 15. I have some concerns that expands or increases the difficulty of a worker to be successful in a claim with such a broad category of injury being outside of the a condition does not contribute to disability such as this. I just have a concern about that. But wouldn't that diminish a worker's chances of getting a successful claim?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, yes, it would. What this exception basically does is continue the current practice that arthritis may be used as a basis to defend a claim denial, or in other words, as a basis of denial, when there's a combined condition involvement in the claim. So how this might work is that a worker has a compensable injury that's accepted. That condition combines with this pre-existing arthritis condition. And at some point, if arthritis becomes the major contributing cause of the disability or need for treatment, then the compensable condition and the benefits that go with that would come to an end. And a denial is typically issued for, is a major contributing cause denial on that combined condition.
Is there a question?
Mr. Chair, just a little bit of a follow-up. I guess my concern would be sort of a chicken and egg concern. I mean, if the arthritis is an exacerbation of the injury, can it then be used, if it becomes the major focus of the disease or of the diagnosis, that can become the reason for denial of a claim?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, if the arthritis, how this pre-existing component works, I'll give you a little broader answer, I think, than what you asked, is that what this group has done is proposed a bill that basically says you can't use pre-existing conditions that have not been diagnosed, have not been treated as a basis for denial, with one exception. In the exception is if it's an arthritis or an arthritic condition. So if arthritis was found by a physician to be a pre-existing condition to the injury and it becomes a combined condition, then yes, I believe under this law it could be used to deny the claim. If the arthritis was traumatically caused, however, by the injury, then I think that's a different scenario.
John, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is actually a narrowing of what can be used to deny under current law.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
And if I just might intervene secondarily, Mr. Chair, is I believe that the group thought that the earlier reforms pre-existing condition was really only supposed to apply to arthritis, and it has been used more broadly by insurers. So the intent of this bill is to narrow it so that other conditions can't be thrown into the pot to deny claims.
Meg, you mentioned earlier reforms and earlier groups. Are you speaking of back all the way 10, 11 years ago to Mahoney Hall?
Yes, and we can just forget that ever happened if you'd like, but yes.
No, I don't think that was the intent of my question. I guess Mahoney Hall, there was a, I don't know, 12, 6, 8, 10 members there?
I believe it's 8.
Eight members there. Were you part of that discussion?
No.
Okay. I believe some of the members who were part of that discussion were also part of this most recent discussions.
That's correct.
Okay, so there is some history from 11 years ago to today's discussions, I guess, is the point I'm trying to make. This hasn't been done in a vacuum, that some of the same people were at both discussions.
That's correct.
May have both been vacuous discussions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Why don't you go ahead and forge into Section 2, unless there's another question here.
Section 2 really relates quite a bit to Section 1, and it's a compensability issue. It talks about burden of proof. Existing law requires that the worker prove that an injury or an occupational disease is compensable throughout the life of the claim, and the burden of proof is entirely on the worker. What this bill does, it requires, for the purpose of a combined condition claim, what we were just talking about, where these pre-existing conditions exist and combine with a compensable injury, that once a worker establishes their compensable injury, that to deny that claim, the employer or the insurer has to bear the burden of proof to establish that the compensable injury isn't or is no longer the major contributing cause of the worker's disability as caused by the combined condition, or their need for treatment for the combined condition. So our analysis is that in Oregon, employers and insurers are still left with formidable defenses in regard to compensability. And I think you'll hear a lot of testimony about this issue, so I want to take a minute and talk about it. Oregon's major contributing cause and combined condition standards that can be used as defense in the case of pre-existing and combined condition remain, even with these proposed changes. These proposed changes do nothing in regard to those standards. These standards remain extremely high when compared nationally. Almost every other state in the nation will still impose less burden on workers to establish a compensable condition where pre-existing conditions are involved in Oregon, even with these changes. But these changes definitely do soften the existing law in regard to compensability. We think the combined effect of these changes in pre-existing conditions and burden of proof will be to increase claims coming into the Oregon workers' compensation system. And we are estimating a cost impact of anywhere between $6.6 and $13.3 million to the system because of these changes alone. And that's going to be because of more injury claims and slightly more occupational disease claims because of the reference to taking out predisposal, which has been used often in occupational disease. Now, the burden of proof part of this law does not change existing occupational disease law at all. It's only the taking out of the words or predisposes, so that the argument that a worker is predisposed to develop a condition can no longer be used as a defense for a denial. There's no change in the burden of proof or what can be used as a pre-existing condition for a major contributing cause denial in occupational disease claims in this law. And I'm bringing this up because this is important, because we have been hearing testimony that cites examples why some object to this portion of the bill that cite conditions that are occupational diseases. And I think it's a fundamental misunderstanding that a lot of people apparently have on this issue.
Senator Harper.
We're going to see these costs or these numbers throughout the bill. Is there an easy way I can relate this to my, you know, my bill that I pay on my business? Percent increase or?
Mr. Chair, Senator Harper, yes, I think so. Our overall, cut to a different part of our analysis, our overall estimate of the impact from the Workers' Compensation Division of the entire package of reforms is about a 1.5% increase in costs overall to the workers' compensation system. That cost increase will be borne by employers in terms, all other things being equal, in terms of impact on the bill that you would pay for your workers' compensation insurance. Other people who will testify will have some slightly different figures, and undoubtedly some others will have drastically different figures.
Aggregate is about a point and a half is what we'll see when we get all that, is what you're saying.
Mr. Chair, Senator Harper, that's what we are projecting. There's some other people who've looked at it are projecting slightly higher.
Could you give us a little background idea how you came up with this percent and a half to 2% number? I mean, all the way through the analysis I've got from you, you've got estimated cost ranges of how did you come up with those figures?
Mr. Chair, we did a very in-depth analysis of each one of the sections and what the impact would be. In some areas, the agreements will create cost increases, it's clear. In some areas, it's less clear what the impact will be, and in some areas, there will be cost decreases to the system. But what we did is we took the information that we know based on the history that we have. For example, in this particular area, we know that there are a certain amount of denials in the system every year. We know how many of those denials are litigated. In other words, where the worker contests the denial. We know how many of those denials are overturned. We took those numbers and we applied to this analysis what we thought these changes in the law would do, frankly, to those borderline cases now that we have, both occupational disease cases, which are very few in number overall in terms of the overall number of claims that are brought forward in the system, and industrial injury claims, which make up the vast majority of the claims that are filed. So the impact's going to be much higher on industrial injury claims. We cited that the highest end impact that we felt would occur because of these changes, especially given the arthritis exception being left in, that is still a broad exception, that there were formidable defenses still for insurers, that we thought the high end was 20% additional claims would come into the system for on-the-job injuries, and perhaps up to 10% additional claims that are occupational diseases. Now, these are claims that are denied today. So these are claims that have to be administered. These are claims that you have to invest money in to sustain the denial because they have to be defended. There are settlements on those claims. Some of those claims are lost at litigation by the defense, and so they do come into the system anyways. So a point to be considered is in the financial analysis is that denial doesn't come free. A denial costs money as well. And so you have to take the amount of additional claims coming into the system and subtract from that the cost of defending the denials. And that's the basis of this analysis in this section. And in other areas, we try to basically establish our assumptions and explain how we came up with the figures that we came up with. I think people can differ on what the assumptions are.
Do your assumptions include everyone now and covered by all forms of workers' comp in Oregon?
Mr. Chair, yes, they do.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Deckard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Didn't I get that right?
Thank you, sir.
Yeah.
John, just along those same lines, can you provide, where applicable, some context to what the problem that arose that precipitated the proposed changes?
Mm-hmm.
What was the issue that we're addressing, where applicable?
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckard, yes, I think I can, and others may be able to add to that quite a bit. In these first two sections that we've just talked about in terms of compensability, the problem that the group was attempting to address were those borderline claims where workers typically feel like there is an injury, it's witnessed. What an example that was used several times, everybody sees the person fall off the truck, and later the claim is denied because it combines with a pre-existing condition that the worker may not have been aware they even had. It had never been symptomatic before. And they were trying to address that issue. They were trying to address the issue of the worker who's coming into the system expecting to have their medical benefits and their time loss benefits taken care of, and they find that maybe subsequent to actually having a compensable claim accepted, that the claim gets denied shortly thereafter for a combined condition that they didn't even know that they had. And I'll try to address that with each stage of this.
Try Section 3.
Section 3 is a section where the group is recommending to raise the limit on temporary total disability benefits, also known as time loss benefits, to 133% of the average weekly wage. Today, we're at 100% of the average weekly wage. The issue that this is basically trying to address is fairer compensation to higher paid workers. It's just a higher limit or higher cap for workers' compensation benefits, and it's going to benefit higher paid workers who today would find themselves getting lower workers' compensation, time loss replacement, or income replacement than what their take-home pay was.
Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. Is that Senator Corcoran?
It is. You talked about workers employed in one job, and that's pretty straightforward. Workers employed in more than one job, you have a formula. Greater of the average weekly wage, average weekly wage resulting from adding all earnings, dividing that amount by total hours worked, and then multiplying the result by the actual hours worked, not to exceed 40 hours. We have workers who work two jobs, you know, and clearly work more than 40 hours. Why would we limit them to 40 hours if they had a pattern of working 50 or 60? That's what they're losing, isn't it? I mean, in the time
left. Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, what the group was trying to get at here was a way to better compensate workers who do work multiple jobs, and you're right, we do have workers who work more than one job and may be working more than 40 hours a week. The agreement that was struck between management and labor was basically, put my own spin on it here, to do a better job of compensating those workers through this formula without providing compensation for every hour that is worked by the employee. So you're correct, Senator. There is that governor on it on 40 hours in the formula.
Just seems somewhat unreasonable to me, Mr. Chair. You know, I mean, I know a lot of work's gone into this, and I don't want to belabor the point, but, you know, these people that work two jobs, I mean, we tend to, you know, praise them in sort of most aspects of life. You know, somebody has the, you know, the desire and the energy enough to work two jobs, and then they get into the workers' comp system, we penalize them.
You know, I guess my only response, Senator, would be that currently the second job isn't considered at all.
Fine. That two wrongs don't make a right.
As you know, there are a lot of compromises in this business.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go.
Thank you.
When there is more than one job, irrespective of the hours, the calculation would be based on the higher paid job, in essence. I think you calculate a whole and then take the higher of whichever job paid more.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Putnam, the calculation would be based on either the worker being paid only for the job at injury or for their multiple jobs, whichever pays better. I think that's slightly different than how you described it, but it's pretty close.
What you said is what I meant.
That's what I meant.
Mr. Chair, without trying to drag this out anymore, I do want to say this is an interesting provision because the extra beyond the employer injury is paid by the workers' benefit fund, which, as you know, is made up of employer and employee contributions. So any changes to that would affect the workers' benefit fund as opposed to insurer expenses. And so it's a little bit different than some of the other provisions and where the money comes from.
Thank you for pointing that out. Ms. Ford, do you have a question? Okay.
Mr. Chair, the next public policy decision is in Section 6, and it relates to permanent disability rates. Existing law provides for permanent partial disability benefits, and there is a sunset in the current law. And the sunset basically takes our existing permanent disability rate structure into the year 2004, when it would be sunsetted, and it would revert back to pre-Senate Bill 460 levels. What this bill does is essentially eliminate the sunset so that permanent disability rates paid to workers for permanent disability remain at the rate that they currently are today. Existing permanent disability rates, in essence, will remain in effect. Now, you may hear some describe this as a cost increase to the system, and I believe that their point is that if current rates sunsetted in 2004 and the rates reverted back to their pre-Senate Bill 460 level, then by preventing this in this bill, that the system actually experiences a cost increase. We rejected that argument basically for two reasons, and I think it's important to bring this up. The existing rates had a sunset put on them in order to force the parties in the legislature to revisit them as an alternative to an automatic rate escalator being put into law. Some of you may recall that there was an automatic permanent partial disability rate escalator in the law briefly in the 1990s. What this bill basically does is makes the existing rates, which are set to sunset in 2004, it makes them permanent. Those current rates that are set to sunset in 2004 are the rates that the pure premium rates are calculated on. And so, to get back to Senator Harper's question earlier, the calculations that go into determining the premium that you pay are based on these current rates. We're just in this bill suggesting that we should remove the sunset, make them permanent, and from that we do not see this as a cost increase.
Senator Harper.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. But, you know, we put that sunset in there to force us to revisit. You know, now we may not ever revisit it. Am I reading this correctly?
Senator,
put on the hold, Senator Harper.
I mean, is that something that we should have considered and didn't, or rejected?
Mr. Chair, Senator Harper, that was considered by the group, and it's pretty typical that the Management Labor Advisory Committee takes this issue up every 2 years because they have a statutory responsibility to look at it and a policy that the rate should remain at the national median.
Yep. Okay. Thanks.
Good.
Section 7, 8, and 9 relate to the time for acceptance or denial of a claim. Currently, in Oregon, there's 90 days for an insurer or self-insured employer to accept or deny a claim. This bill proposes to lessen that time frame to 60 days. These changes address concerns by workers that the timeliness of decisions are too long in terms of acceptance or denial of the claim. And some have suggested that the shorter timeline for acceptance or denial may result in more denials because insurers will not have sufficient time to evaluate the claim. However, according to Safe Corporation, their average days to accept or deny a claim is 27 days. So the actual impact on the parties may not be as significant as some believe. Although there's going to be a certain number of complicated claims that will undoubtedly present real challenges to accept or deny within 60 days. 60 days or less was the standard in Oregon until 1990 and remains the standard in many states today. And the 60-day timeline shortens the period of uncertainty regarding payment of medical bills, which is a large concern for workers and medical providers.
So quick before we ask the question.
Mm-hmm. The next sections are sections 10 and 11, which relate to board's own motion jurisdiction. Existing law authorizes the Workers' Compensation Board to act on its own motion to reopen a claim for temporary disability benefits in claims where a worker suffers a worsening of his or her condition more than 5 years after the claim closure or the date of injury. The current law also requires that when new and omitted condition claims are found compensable after claim closure, the claim must be reopened for processing, regardless of the board's own motion. What this bill does is it specifies that claims that may be reopened by the board now include claims where the worsening prevents the worker from working and requires either hospitalization or other curative treatment in lieu of hospitalization to enable the worker to return to work. The costs for these reopenings are reimbursed to the insurer from the worker benefit fund. And the problem that the group was trying to get at was that medical science has advanced beyond our law currently. And many physicians felt that they were providing curative treatment to disabled workers outside of a hospitalization. And that the law required for benefits to be paid, temporary disability benefits to be paid, that an actual hospitalization occur. So they were trying to address that issue. And then secondly, there was a problem with new and omitted medical conditions that arise 5 years after the date of closure or date of injury, that those claims may not act like other claims in the system, that they weren't congruent with other standards within the system. They weren't subject to the aggravation standard. They were not necessarily subject to the board's own motion jurisdiction. And the end result of that is insurers found themselves having to reserve many more dollars in terms of setting aside money to pay for those claims if they were reopened, which they would not have to do if those claims were subject to the aggravation standard. What this bill does, it provides that these claims are now subject to the aggravation standard with one difference, that these claims can have permanent partial and permanent total disability awards under the board's own motion, which other types of claims, aggravation claims, other types of board's own motion claims are not subject to those benefits. These claims would have those benefits, and the reason that the group felt that that was fair to do is because those claims enjoy those benefits today and they didn't want to take those away. But what they did do is they put basically those claims into the same type of standards, the board's own motion jurisdiction of all other claims, which substantially, significantly limits the amount of exposure to insurers and self-insured employers in the long run. This is an area where there are substantial savings for employers, and it might be worth a minute to talk about how we figured the costs or savings in this case, in this particular case, because there's going to be dramatic differences of opinion around this, about the size of overall cost savings to insurers and self-insured employers as a result of the changes to new and omitted conditions. We're estimating a savings of $13.6 million annually to the system, and that's based on, number one, Safe Corporation's estimate of a $12 million annual impact to them alone, and they represent about a third of the system in Oregon because of these types of claims. Testimony by the Oregon workers' compensation attorneys in front of MLAC, which indicated these were a significant number of claims, and conversation with other plaintiff and defense attorneys. These organizations believe that the exposure here was quite significant, and the group of six believe the exposure here was quite significant. On the other hand, you'll hear testimony from other employers and insurers, I'm sure, that estimate the impact of this exposure to be quite a bit lower. So because of that, GCBS took SAFE's estimate and discounted it by 50% and projected the impact of the workers' compensation system based on SAFE's overall percentage of the industry's annual loss costs. So we're discounting what our largest insurer basically said the impact was going to be by 50% and still came out with a $13.6 million savings to the system for these changes. Very technical, but they're significant.
Mr. Chair?
Just another general question. These numbers, I see SAFE's estimate. Yeah, they're just one of the players. Do we have other estimates, or is that going to be other testimony?
We have to ask the other insurers if they're testifying.
Mr. Chair, Senator Harper, we have not been provided information from other insurers specifically, but I'm sure they'll come up here and give you their data.
Okay. Yeah. Are they going to be consistent? Are we going to see some differences? But we don't know that.
We haven't received it yet.
Thank you, Senator Worthy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you clarify how you arrived at the discounted 50%?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley. Yes. It was less than arbitrary, but somewhat in that direction. And that was because in conversations that I had with other insurers, they were indicating a significant less impact on them. A self-insured employer had told me, we haven't had any of these types of claims. So I took from that experience that they felt their exposure was zero. I was aware of board cases. I was aware of Court of Appeals cases where these claims were occurring, where they were being reopened, where, frankly, in one case where a worker was unable to reopen their claim under an aggravation standard, but was able to reopen their claim under a new medical condition claim. And it presents a significant exposure to an insurer who tries to reserve the claim and bring it to a close and release those reserves at some point. It's somewhat like if you had a car accident. At some point, you want to know that your experience with that car accident, the financial experience, is going to end. Workers' compensation claims have a notoriously long tail on them. They last a long time. But the way our law functions with board's own motion is that after 5 years, an insurer has a pretty good idea of what the medical expenses are going to be left on that claim, and they're not going to be subject to any more disability or indemnity benefit expenses. These new medical condition claims and omitted medical condition claims circumvented that, and so insurers were unable to release their reserves for indemnity benefits, those who thought the exposure was significant, and many did. The impact was going to be, it was going to raise expenses significantly for employers as reserves are set aside. That's money that's not going to be released to either have lower rates or are going to be given back in dividends or whatever. Did I answer your question, Senator?
There's an answer in there. Simply, what I heard is it was arbitrary, less than arbitrary, but somewhere in that direction.
Yeah.
That basically told me what I needed to
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, on many of these cost impact estimates, we can feel very secure that based on data that we have, that we're pretty close. In several of them, we can't. We're trying to estimate what's going to happen based on new case law here. And we just don't have a tremendous amount of data to look at to be very sure about our estimates. So I took what I thought was a pretty good analysis done by our largest insurer here in the state and discounted it by 50% and said, this is what I think the savings are going to be.
We can move on, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Let's go.
Okay. Section 12 is on modified employment and deposition at reconsideration. What this bill basically tries to do is give workers the right to refuse modified employment without loss of temporary disability benefits in some very specific instances that are outlined in the bill, and I won't touch on each one of them now. It also gives the worker the right to submit a deposition when appealing an insurer's claim closure that is subject to cross-examination by the insurer. In both of these cases, the group was trying to address issues of fairness for workers. There was a feeling that return to work was a very good thing for workers, a very good thing for employers, a very good thing for the system, but there were some abuses that were beginning to surface, and they wanted to give the worker the right to refuse offers of modified employment without losing their benefits under certain circumstances. And they're wanting to give the right to the worker to submit a deposition during reconsideration, basically the ability to tell their story when they think it's important to do so.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
So this issue of on page 17, one of the criteria for modified employment is that if it requires the worker to change shifts, if the employee has no written shift change policy, or if the required shift change is not consistent with the existing written shift change policy. Did you have any discussion about how many employers that have shift work have such policies?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, I believe that the group did have quite a bit of discussion about that.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, nothing would prohibit an employer, if it's assuming that it's a non-union situation, from changing working conditions, i.e. creating a shift policy overnight if they didn't have one. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, I assume so. That's probably something that we may want to ask Bureau of Labor and Industries to give some comment to that might go outside my area of expertise.
Mr. Chair, just sort of one follow-up then. Do you know why this arose as an issue, just out of curiosity, the whole notion of shift change being an exception to this? I mean, Senator Deckard had asked earlier, you know, that when you could, to give examples of, you know, what had happened in the workplace with regards to these issues. I'm just kind of, as a former Lane County Deputy Sheriff who had to change shifts every 2 weeks, I'm real curious about this one. And I was a parent at the time, too, with a young baby. And I'd be very concerned that an employer, especially, again, in a non-represented situation, could really wreak havoc with an injured worker's life. If they were a single parent, you know, if they, had considerations in their, in their own lives, personal lives. And I just wonder if there's any discussion about having some kind of mechanism in there to allow the worker to appeal, an arbitrary shift policy creation.
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, existing law basically doesn't address this at all.
Okay.
inside of return to work. An employer can ask a worker to return on any shift.
Okay.
Most employers don't do that. That's not a practice that's widely seen. And what they were attempting to do here was to put some control back in the hands of the worker, to basically be able to decline or refuse to return to work when there is a bona fide offer of modified or light duty employment with the employer if it requires the worker to change shifts, unless the employer has a shift change policy. I think that there's probably room still inside of this for some abuse to go on. On the other hand, I think that when an employer engages in that sort of practice, it's and this again is not really my area of expertise, but from what I know, that's rather dangerous practice. The Bureau of Labor might take a dim view, and the worker might feel they're being discriminated against if that practice is being aimed at an injured worker, and it's not being followed with some others.
And Mr. Chair, I don't know that injured worker would be a category of, would that be a category that would be covered by, okay, I'm getting a nod out there from all the legal experts, so. Thank you.
Okay, that's the 13th.
Okay, I'm getting towards the end, Mr. Chair. Section 13 relates to independent medical examinations, or IMEs as they're known in the industry. An existing law requires any worker entitled to receive compensation to submit to a medical examination if requested to do so by their insurer or their self-insured employer. This bill simply requires insurers requesting an independent medical examination to provide the worker with the names of three qualified physicians or panel of physicians drawn from a list that's maintained by the Department of Consumer and Business Services. It allows the worker to choose the health care provider who will administer the IME from the provided list of three. And it requires the director to adopt standards for inclusion on and criteria for exclusion from the IME provider list.
Okay. Section 14. 15 and 16.
Sections 14, 15, and 16 relate to interim medical benefits. This bill provides that payment by the workers' compensation insurance company for expenses that are associated with diagnostic services, medication to relieve pain, and services to stabilize the worker and to prevent disability, where those services are incurred prior to acceptance of the claim. Current law does not require the insurer to pay for medical expenses incurred prior to acceptance of the claim, and it allows health insurers to deny coverage where an injury or occupational disease occurred at work or was work-related. This provides that for claims ultimately found not to be compensable, the insurers have rights. Once they make these payments, they have rights to subrogate against the worker's health insurer. Or where there is no health insurer, the insurer may recover costs directly from the worker. And it also allows for a provision that exists currently in law, workers' compensation law, for a recovery of an overpayment if a worker files a subsequent claim. There's three levels of recovery here.
Senator Perkin. Is there any mechanism, or was there any discussion about how a worker would be warned, in essence, notified, in essence, that if they were to seek treatment outside the workers' comp system and later have the claim denied, that the employer could come back on that worker for the cost?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, there was some discussion about that during the course of the discussions, and it was one of those issues that was felt that the department could handle an administrative rule process to put some rules in place that the worker needs to understand the how this would work and to get some notice about it.
I just wonder in reality, Mr. Chair, how what that would look like. I mean, you have people working in some pretty isolated environs, right? And, you know, an injury occurs. I mean, couldn't you have the situation now because of the arthritis that we talked about earlier that the compensability would come in question because of a pre-existing condition, as you said earlier, that the worker may not even know about at the time, and then the worker seeks treatment, and now the employer can come back on the worker. What problem is this solving? What existed before that prompts us now to allow the employer to come back at the worker for those health care costs.
Well, let me try to address that one. Currently, the worker can be denied any coverage until the claim is accepted. What this is an attempt to get at is, let's get that worker some coverage if he's got a hurt back. And if it is then determined that it is not a workers' comp claim, then either his health insurance is going to pick it up or he's going to have to pay for it himself. But currently, the issue is that worker gets no coverage until the claim is accepted. And this is an attempt to get the person the treatment, get him stable, and then decide who's going to pay the bills.
Well, Mr. Chair, you know, with all due respect, a worker is in a, you know, always in a subsidiary position to an employer. And a low-earning worker who may not have health care coverage, it's not required, there's no employer mandate for health care coverage, gets an injury, and apparently we're going to come up with some way to notify this worker that if he or she does seek treatment, that that they may be liable for the cost of that treatment if they don't have health insurance and they have a pre-existing condition that they don't even know about at the time, that the employer may get to come back at them. And what I would submit to you, Mr. Chair, is, and I understand that what you're saying, you know, what currently exists is even worse, but again, I'm not sure we're in terms of equity. I think you create a chilling effect on that worker, and especially if you then give that worker warning that, you know what, go seek treatment if you don't have health insurance, but if your claim's denied, you're going to pay for it. I wonder what effect that's going to have on the worker seeking medical treatment. That's my concern.
Well, if your concern is that we warn the employee that they may come back on them, we don't have to warn the employee.
Well, my point is that the employee should get some warning about that. I mean, you can do what you want to do. You know, employers do whatever they want. A lot of them don't insure their workers, you know. I mean, you can think that's reasonable or not reasonable, but I'm just saying that, you know, warning a worker that this is the consequence. In the case of low-income workers without health insurance and without union representation, for instance, I would think would have a chilling effect on that worker seeking treatment.
Senator Deckard, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the remedy today when an insurer finds himself in that situation where the compensation has been denied and they don't have the avenues that you described available to them today?
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckard, if an insurer, there's a couple of ways that can work. If an insurer has enrolled a worker into a managed care organization, an MCO, as it's known in the industry, prior to acceptance or denial of the claim, the insurer is responsible to pay any reasonable and necessary service provided that are not otherwise covered by health insurance, even if the claim is ultimately denied. Okay, so during that interim period, if they choose to enroll them in an MCO, they have to pay for it what the health insurance doesn't cover.
Even if the claim is denied?
Correct.
They still make, okay.
Correct. So that's one instance. In this particular portion of the bill, that's an important exception that the bill addresses, and it says, you know, except for when that happens, this is what we would do. So in all other cases, the insurers today are not required to make medical payments on a non-compensable claim, and they collect the payments as they come in, they hold them. Some insurers choose to pay some of them, and that's out-of-pocket cost, especially those diagnostic services that help establish that the claim is not compensable. And then the claim then is turned back over to the worker's health insurer, if they have any, or the worker becomes responsible. My experience in going to any medical provider is I'm almost always now required to sign some sort of statement that I'm going to be responsible if my health insurance doesn't pick up the cost. And that, in all due respect, Senator Corcoran, that can have a chilling effect. I mean, if I feel like my health insurance isn't going to pay for all of it, I may or may not have it done. It's You know, it's just my personal experience.
Do you have health insurance?
I certainly do. I'm lucky.
400,000, 300,000 Oregonians don't.
And I would just add, when we calculated the cost of this, we took into account that over half of all claims are accepted, and 88% of workers have health insurance. So we're hoping that it's just a real small number of people that you'd actually have to go back. And certainly we've had testimony from employers saying they would never go after their own worker for health care coverage. So it's one of those things we'll have to see what happens prospectively.
In reality, though, the employer wouldn't be going after the worker for the cost. It would be the insurer going after the worker for the cost.
Mr. Chair, it'd be the...
No, not the workers' comp insurer.
Yes, it would be the workers' compensation insurer or the self-insured employer.
Okay, go ahead.
Section 17 through 20 refer to the Employer Liability Act. An existing law allows a worker to bring a suit against a third party who's responsible for or in charge of any work involving risk or danger to an employee or to the public, regardless of the worker's individual contribution to the industry. This bill allows comparative fault as a defense in actions brought against parties responsible for or in charge of any work involving a risk or a danger to an employee or the public under the Employer's Liability Act. So what this proposed change will do is preclude a worker from prevailing in a suit against a third party, such as a general contractor, where the worker is more than 50% at fault. This means that workers will prevail in less Employers Liability Act claims than under current law. There is a financial impact to workers' compensation insurers, as there'll be some, and it's an unknown number, we don't know how many, number of suits that are currently settled or won by workers that will no longer be won or even brought forward. As insurers and self-insured employers file liens currently against worker settlements in these cases, they are going to see fewer claims in which they can file liens and recover some of their workers' compensation costs. We estimate the impact of these unrecovered claims costs to be 1.0 to 2.4 million annually. And that was based on information that we got from the industry in terms of the numbers of third-party claims that they have that would be related to Employers Liability Act, and making some estimates over the last 3 years about the number of claims and the amount of recovery. However, the impact of these unrecovered claims costs to employers are offset by lower defense costs, employers benefiting from paying out less in settlements and for judgments, and in lowered liability insurance costs. The net effect of this change would be significant savings to employers.
Senator Deckard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the obvious question on this is that this is tort reform, which I supported in a standalone bill last session, but nonetheless tort reform. And why is it in a workers' comp bill?
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckert, the group that was putting together this package of reforms felt that workers' compensation is also tort reform, and that the workers' compensation system already deals with an administrated way to basically provide for claims that are filed for injuries. And it was basically a compromise amongst the group. It was important to members of the group to address this issue. They felt that there were a lot of lawsuits that were being filed and a lot of costs that were being generated that really ought not to be there. And the group looked at this and felt that this was one of the things that they could compromise on, and they placed it inside of the group of proposals. And I honestly feel that others of the group could describe their motivations much better than I can.
But it was solely within the NLAC group that this decision was made.
Senator Deckert, I think we're going to hear probably next from some of the people who were in those negotiations, and perhaps they would be better to answer some of the questions that have been raised by this group than the people who were administering what they were doing.
Mm-hmm. Great.
That's true.
Senator Corcoran.
But it always is comforting to know that the people that are actually going to administer this know what they're talking about. The one question I would have, Mr. Chair, just procedurally then, since this is acknowledged as a, you know, a tort reform measure within this workers' comp bill, are you going to be referring this then to judiciary?
No.
Okay, thank you.
One more section.
One more section. Section 23, it deals with exclusive remedy, which is the heart of the bargain of the workers' compensation system, and it really is the heart of workers' compensation systems nationally. The exclusive remedy refers to that compromise that I talked about early in my testimony, where workers basically give up their rights to sue for certain benefits, and employers provide insurance benefits in order to avoid those suits. Existing law sunsets our current exclusive remedy law in December of 2004. This bill deletes that sunset. The workers' compensation system will continue as the exclusive remedy for workers injured on the job, leaving intact the prohibition on bringing civil suits against an employer for work-related injuries as a result of this bill.
What section of the bill actually does that? I mean, you said Section 23, but the way current law is on workers' compensation is very hard to read. I know 2 years ago, I think it took me 4 hours to figure out how this happened. So let's make it very clear. It is Section 23 that does away with the sunset of the repeal of workers' compensation. Is that...
Mr. Chair, I'm checking to just make sure, and yes, it's Section 23.
Okay. We just want to make sure that for those of us who don't live this every day, the current statutes are very confusing to try to figure out how it works.
Mr. Chair, especially the sunset statutes, because a lot of those are
they're backward sunsets.
Yeah, it's very confusing.
Thank you. The obvious question that I have to ask just about every bill this session. We've been working on this now for 11 years. What's the emergency?
Mr. Chair, I think you can tell by the participation in this room that there's a lot of interest in the workers' compensation system, and this group got together partially because there were some initiatives being proposed, and so obviously there's some real emotional and serious perceived and real problems in the system, and that's what brought this group together. And the governor wanted to make sure that we could get...
I understand that part.
Okay.
Section 24.
Oh, the emergency, the real emergency.
What is the emergency? Why does the bill have an emergency clause?
Mr. Chair, if I may, this bill addresses several, and we just went over them, several substantive benefits to injured workers, as well as some pretty significant cost savings to employers. And it's a package of compromises, but they're very important. And the group felt that the sooner that these could be put into law, at the earliest possible date, the better it would be for everyone involved to begin to take care of some of these very difficult and unfair, I don't know any other word that would describe it, unfair situations. And the sooner that we take care of these, the better. And so they did request that we ask Legislative Council for an emergency clause.
And I'm not picking on you directly, but last session we passed a bill that said all new laws will take effect on a date certain from now on, which would be the first of the year following sine die, and I don't think I think I've seen one bill this session without an emergency clause. So obviously, people didn't like a bill being, you know, laws changing on a certain day of the year every time. So maybe we should rescind our 1998 law and go back to the way it was before.
Well, Senator Durfer wants to sine die in a week or so, and I think that might be the push too.
That worked for me also, Senator.
Aye.
We can make that happen.
Aye.
Thank you very much for the thorough review of the bill, and I'm sure we're not done with you.
Thank you very much for listening.
Yeah.
How about a couple of probably disinterested parties today, Lisa Trussell and Bob Shiprock? Would you like to come up together? And seeing how your names are on the bill indirectly.
Kumbaya.
And Tim Nesbitt also, that's true. His name's on the bill too, isn't it? we're not limiting testimony. We've pretty well heard the bill. I guess if you could answer some questions that hopefully you were taking notes of some of the questions were raised about motivation and why you did what you did in your negotiations, and maybe just a little bit of that kind of background. I don't think we need to walk through the bill section by section again.
Well, I'd be pleased to start, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Tim Nesbitt, president of the Oregon AFL-CIO, and we are pleased to support the bill, subject to some refinements requested of MLAC, but support the bill in all its major provisions. We participated. I was one of this group of six. Two others are to my right. Meeting for about 4 months. We had extensive discussions and good faith negotiations that produced the product you have in front of you as Senate Bill 485. I would add my perspective as I presented it to our own board in May of last year, which voted which voted unanimously to support the package, that this is not really an overhaul of the system, but it is a package of reforms, which we think are long overdue. We believe that the changes made in 1990 and 95 combined had swung the pendulum away from fairness to injured workers in the system, and this package starts to move the pendulum back a few notches, but in very important ways. And I think John Schiltz summarized those for you. We also point out that there are a number of elements here which are outright improvements to workers, others which basically shift a cost that's in the system now to the workers' fund rather than from employers to the workers' fund. That's in regard to the new and omitted conditions claims. And then some which, as part of the package, we can support, but would not have supported absent agreement on the whole package. And in particular, I'd like to respond to the point that this is in some way that the inclusion of the changes to the ELA is in some way inappropriate or not germane to the package. We see the ELA and our workers' comp system as addressing, both of these address the issue of compensation for workers hurt on the job. And in fact, our workers' comp system postdated and preempts the ELA. And continues to preempt it in all but multi-employer settings. And even in those settings, awards under the ELA are used to offset claims under the workers' comp system. So there's a very real connection between the two. And this does not go as far as the bill that that you passed in the last session, which was vetoed by the governor, but it does make some of those same changes in the context of this package, which also significantly, on the bottom line, improves the system for workers who are hurt on the job. And in that context, we are willing to support that change, and in fact, our board has endorsed all the changes in the bill as a package.
Thank you. Questions? You must have done a good job. You answered all the questions. Lisa or Bob,
what's going to... I'm going to go next. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Bob Shiprack, Oregon Building Trades, and part of the group of six, as you got to be called. I'm going to try and address, following your request, Mr. Chairman, to try and hit some of the points that the committee was inquiring on. I think that's a very good question as to why we did some of the things that we did. In no particular order, I just wrote down some of the things Senator Corcoran asked about, why the shift language was put into the bill. That was not an issue of mine. It was raised by particularly workers in manufacturing settings where there is a lot of shift work, and we dealt with that in order to stop some of the abuses of where there was an attempt to dissuade a worker from either filing claims or pursuing claims by moving their shift around. And as the senator pointed out, if you're a single parent or something, that type of harassment is pretty powerful. Does it happen every day? No, and I'm not suggesting that. But it's an issue that was raised. All of the points that we put into this package, I should have started this first, were to deal with nagging problems of the system that we have all heard about for many, many years. It was not done in a vacuum. In fact, we called Maria Carraher, who's the workers' comp ombudsman at the department, over and asked her. They now record a list of all the complaints that injured workers phone in on, and we just asked, you know, what are the top five that you hear about? I work with my folks every day. I hear from them what's going on out there in the workplace, as does Tim and the rest of the, at least the labor folks. So we attempted to address these problems so they would, we would quit having to fight over them every session here in the legislature. And that's what you've got here, is a list of things that we're trying to fix, both on the management side and the labor side. Let's just quit the warfare. Let's sit down together and fix these problems. And it took us 5 months. We worked on these, and that's what the package you have in front of you. Getting back to some of the other questions that were asked, interim medical benefits. Let me tell you what's going on. It used to be not a problem. The insurer or self-insured employer would pay the medical benefits up until the time, and they still do, some of them. But what's happened, and I didn't understand this, we went back and researched it. The problem is that the health care providers will not pay until the comp carrier makes a decision. So you can have a worker out there who's got a very serious injury who may have only gotten emergency room treatment. Nobody's going to pay. I haven't accepted or denied the claim. The health care provider says, she's filed a work comp claim. I'm not paying. So you got this situation. What we said was stop this silliness. This person's hurt. We know if they don't get good medical treatment now, their disability is likely to be worse than if we had taken care of his medical problems at the beginning. I used my own example. I hurt my back, herniated a disc. Orthopedic surgeons will tell you if you wait over 6 weeks, you may suffer permanent nerve damage. You should have it operated on prior to if it in fact needs it. And those are some of the timelines that doctors and medical people today know that's not occurring. And so we tried to deal with it in this fashion. The other thing that came up and is part of this package is our workforce has changed in the last decade. We didn't used to talk about part-time employees. Now there are whole industries that won't hire full-time workers. They only want part-time workers. So you've got people, hard-working, honest people, doing their employer a heck of a job, who have to work two, maybe three jobs. That's just the way the workforce is changing. So we tried to address that problem about those people who are raising families, working two or three jobs, who unfortunately get hurt at work and have bills they have to pay, and try and modernize how the comp system compensates for them so that they have an equal footing as far as when they are injured on the job. Minor fiscal impact, but it was, again, an equity thing. We raised the time loss benefits to 133% of the state average weekly wage. Higher paid workers also have bills and things. The intent of workers' compensation was to attempt to pay the worker for their loss of earning capacity while they were off work due to an industrial injury or disease, and it helps with those folks. Tim has eloquently talked about the Employer Liability Act. I would add just one other thing, and was not brought up by the department. This is further narrowed in that the Employer Liability Act only applies to hazardous occupations, and it's in the statute. It's frankly, my construction workers are probably the most impacted by this, and I support the language in the bill, and I totally agree with Tim that it has there's a very good reason why it's included in this package, and that workers have an option of going one way or the other, and they wouldn't be there if it wasn't because of a workplace or injury or disease. The other thing I wanted that was brought up as well, and it'll be the last thing I'll talk about, and it has to do with the pre-existing condition issue. We did a study during the interim, and I asked Meg to bring one over. I forgot mine. I would encourage the committee staff to provide one to you. And we had a perception there were too many workers who were suffering. They had an incident. They're on the shop floor, whatever. They fall off the ladder. Everybody sees it. Yet their claims are being denied because of a pre-existing condition. When there is no doubt that there was an incident, the worst, in this study that came out, if you can believe this, there are claims being denied by people that are burned, take falls downstairs and have head injuries, have puncture wounds, who cut themselves and do other things, and their claims are denied because of a pre-existing condition. Explain that to me, but it's happening. That's what's going on in the workplace, in workers' compensation. It's documented. It's in the report. Our intent here was to try and stop this practice of denying legitimate claims by the use of the pre-existing condition escape clause that's in the statute. It's been misused. We wanted to correct the language and put it in perspective so that people who had honest industrial accidents in this case could get their claim accepted without the game going on. Most of them were litigated. That worker typically won, but they had to be drugged through the system to get their claim accepted. I'll stop there, and there's another, it's a big bill, and but Lisa's here, and there's other people, but I would be happy to answer any of your questions that you've got. I want the committee to understand exactly what this bill does, because you'll probably hear some things that it doesn't do.
Thank you. We'll have Lisa, and then there's questions. We'll ask the whole group.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Lisa Truffle, and I'm with Associated Oregon Industries. Our members employ approximately 30% of the private workforce in Oregon. And we're here today, obviously, in support of Senate Bill 485. We believe that Senate Bill 485 is a fair and balanced compromise. And I think that's a significant point. This is a compromise. And it contains issues that had significant importance to our members. Little background piece before I go into it. Back in 1989, at the end of the legislative session, our president, Richard Buttrick, approached then-Governor Neil Goldschmidt and Mr. Nesbitt's predecessor, Irv Fletcher, at the AFL-CIO, about getting a group of people together, employers and employees, to discuss problems within the workers' compensation system. And that discussion and idea resulted in the Mahonia Hall 1990 reforms that I think all of Oregon should be very proud of. We not only lowered our premiums and reduced costs, roughly 60% reduction over the last 11 years, which is roughly $6 billion. We also increased benefits 3- and 4-fold on the permanent disability awards, and that's a significant accomplishment. So we're very invested as an organization in maintaining the spirit and intent of the 1990 reforms. The group that worked on this package that's before you is Senate Bill 485. Three of us were physically in the room at Mahonia Hall in 1990. Myself, Mr. Shiprack, and John Egge with MP Plumbing. And then the other three people who participated in this package weren't with their organizations in 1990 or weren't a part of the Mahonia Hall discussions in 1990, but their organizations were. Mr. Nesbitt, as I already indicated, Irv Fletcher participated in 1990. AFSCME was represented by Cecil Tibbetts in 1990 and Ken Allen this last year. And Hoffman Construction had an individual named J.D. Hutchinson who participated in 1990, and this go around it was Mr. Dan Harmon. Senate Bill 485 addresses for our members basically three major issues, and Mr. Schiltz and Mr. Nesbitt and Shiprack have both touched on one of them, which is the Employer Liability Act. The other two deal with the sunset and the threat of rolling back the provisions that we made a part of the law in 1995 dealing with exclusive remedy. This proposal eliminates the threat of that rollback for those provisions that we put in. And it also addresses issues relating to new and omitted medical conditions. And that is a compromise issue on those conditions. But we believe it's a good compromise in that it will save the system money. And Mr. Schultz covered all of these in great detail. One of the things I wanted to point out and make clear on the interim meds piece that was presented, the question came up about current law today. If we steer a worker into a managed care organization, we're paying for their treatment under current law. If the worker is outside that managed care organization and seeks treatment on their own and the claim is denied, those bills are not paid. If the claim is ultimately accepted, you back up and pick up those costs. But currently, those costs aren't covered. So this is a compromise to address this issue, and I think most of you will recall that this issue was significant last legislative session. With regards to elimination of the sunset on the permanent partial disability, which I believe Senator Harper had a question on, what this is doing is it doesn't have a rollback impact. We're eliminating the threat of rolling it back to what I think was 1995 levels. But it simply sets in statute the current rates we're paying. To increase that, you would have to have legislative action, which we have historically done since the 1990 reforms. Each time the legislature has met, we've taken a look at where we are. And it's been kind of an informal agreement that as long as we were able to control costs, that we wanted to keep benefits at the national median. And we've been successfully doing that for the last decade. So all this does is eliminates the threat of a rollback. Keeps it in statute, but the discussions need to, you know, we need to have those discussions periodically as to what the appropriate level is. There's been some discussion about going from 90 days to 60 days on the compensability decision, and we had information presented to us that shows there are a good number of states that have significantly shorter timelines to make these decisions. One of the points I expressed during the discussion is that from my perspective, and I may be the only person that has this perspective, but to me it's a savings. As an employer, you've just cut off my responsibility for 60 days worth of time loss, potential time loss that I may have if I don't issue that denial because I'm investigating the claim. The other thing that I think is interesting is if you look at some of the statistics from the department on those timelines for compensability decisions, it was mentioned previously that 60 days was where we were in 1990 or 89 prior to the reforms. It's basically the same percentage of claims exceeded 60 days in 1989 as exceed 90 days, and I think we looked at 1998's numbers. And the reason I believe for that is that there are going to be a certain amount of claims that wherever you put the timeline, you're not going to be able to get the meds on. Last session, there was a proposal to bring it down to 45 days. So 60 is where we were before, and I might add that if I recall correctly, and Bob was there too, the idea to go from 60 to 90 days back in 1990 was actually labor's suggestion. We had talked about some issues with backup denials and things, and they said, well, if you had more time, could you make a better compensability decision? And we said, sure. So I would argue that, though. But anyway, that issue, is something that we've had before, and other states have much shorter. And the last thing I want to touch on, and then I'll shut up for a while, is on this issue with multiple jobs and looking at time loss for those jobs, this is an issue that's come up probably prior to the 1997 session by some of the labor members of the Management Labor Advisory Committee. And the concern was people that are now working multiple part-time jobs. And in my mind, I couldn't understand how you could possibly come up with a solution for that under traditional insurance laws, because how can you rate a risk that isn't yours, which is how I saw this to be developing. Well, during these discussions, when we were working on this project, lo and behold, I discovered that there were 27 or 28 states that take into consideration employees with multiple jobs. And in those states, a majority of those states, I shouldn't say majority, many, because I can't remember the number, quite a few of them, those states did it based on the last employer. If you were the employer that had them employed when they got hurt, you looked at all the wages and you paid for it. Well, Oregon, as you all know, is a state of small employers. 89% of our employers are in the small employer category. That would be very hard for them on their insurances to have to cover risks they don't have. So what we agreed to in a compromise was that the worker brings it forward that they have multiple jobs, that they're impacted, that the rate can be calculated out based on that, and there'll be a reimbursement for the part that exceeds what the employer that had them when they got hurt should pay. So the employer is only going to pay, be rated for their portion of, or their responsibility. The part that's in addition to that will come from the worker benefit fund, which is a cents per hour assessment that we as workers and employers pay into. As the discussions continue, we'll be providing written comment. As Tim has indicated, there's this bill is a good bill as written, but we expect some improvements to enhance it to come out of the Management Labor Advisory Committee, and we'll be providing those in the future.
Thank you. Hopefully we'll have some enhancements to approve it from out of this committee also that the Management Labor Advisory Committee can look at.
That's true. Ms. Tressel, I have a little bit different reflection on Mahonia Hall because our union was kicked out of the discussions. But you mentioned that there was $6 billion worth of savings that have accrued because of the Mahonia Hall reforms. And do you know what our rating was vis-a-vis other states in 1990 and what it is now?
It depended on whose study. It was somewhere between fifth and eighth highest, depending on whose you were looking at. And I haven't looked recently, but I would think that we're somewhere around 23 to 28 now. But there'll be others in the room that can answer that.
23 to 28, huh? I thought we were higher than that. That answers my question.
Higher as in?
As in that we had lower costs for the system than, I thought we were ranked about 40th out of 50 states in terms of cost to the system to the employer.
So by saying higher than that, you mean we were a lower cost state?
That's right.
Aren't you glad you came to the committee?
Well, I don't know if I've learned it yet.
Senator Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Any part of the Comprehensive Act drew the most, or one or two areas, drew the most contention. And I guess I'd tag on, what areas are continuing to need to be worked on where you're bringing amendments?
Do you want to talk the amendments first?
The amendments that Lisa alluded to, I mentioned to AMLAC at their last meeting, but they have to do with definition of pre-existing conditions and a reference to a modifying provision or clause that basically says for the purpose of this subparagraph only, which might have too much of a limiting effect. That would be on page 4, lines 12 through 16. I think we'll have agreement on how to fix that. This is basically a matter of making sure the language reflects the agreement. And finally, all the way at the back of the bill, where you have the effective dates, More work needs to be done to make sure that all the dates line up correctly. There's not, for instance, a change being made to the ELA on one date and the new provisions taking effect some days later. And we think, again, that with a little more staff work on this, we can fix this and make sure they all line up appropriately.
I've got a suggestion. Take off the emergency clause. They all take effect the 1st of January next year. Meg, while you're here, I see you're back in the room. Bob said that you have a copy of a report that they used dealing with injuries, and we would like to get a copy of that to the committee members. Just make them available to Mr. Putman, and he can get them to the rest of us.
Mr. Chair, if I may, and Senator Decker, a couple of the other areas as Mr. Schultz had indicated, there's been quite a bit of discussion at IMLAC and some suggestions coming in there. It's saying that we had agreed to work on through the IMLAC process dealt with arthritis, and that's one. And there'll probably be some others that I'm not thinking of right now, but that's kind of the general idea. Nothing that changes what, in my opinion, changes what we agreed to. It's just maybe wording it better.
Mr. Chair? Senator Harper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Give me a little help. I think I've got most of it, but I'm going to go home, assuming we pass this out, assuming I vote for it. I'm going to go home, and I'm going to go to the mill and talk to the swing shift about changing workers' comp. And we'll do pretty good. I've got Tim's newsletter, so they'll probably buy me beers at the mill. But the next time I'm going to go to the Chamber of Commerce and explain what happened, why we're raising the rates. And Bob, I thought that was about the best I've heard this thing, but can you just give me a little help on things that I need to make sure that I take home with me about why we're doing it?
Mr. Chair and Senator Harper, if I may, one of the most significant things that we keep in the state of Oregon is major contributing cause. And that was an issue we didn't quite answer the last part of Senator Deckert's question, but clearly there was a lot of discussion around that in the report that Mr. Shiprack referred to that will be given out. It discusses that. But we have still agreed that in Oregon, work needs to be the primary need for your treatment in order to be compensable. And as Mr. Schultz indicated in his report, that's a significant issue for employers. The other thing is that depending on whose numbers you look at, on the correction for new and omitted medical conditions, that's a $200 million problem in a $600 million system. And we address that in this bill. The other thing we address is we've addressed the threat of the rollback on the language that was put in 1995 dealing with exclusive remedy. That concern, when that language, what that does is say that if you have a denied workers' compensation claim, you can't be sued. And as we know, that's being litigated. But and depending on the outcome of that case, things could change from could be disastrous to it might just take some minor adjustments. We don't know what the outcome will be. And the other issue is the changes in the compromise made on the Employer Liability Act is impacting more people. When this issue was first brought to AOI years ago, it was primarily a construction issue, construction industry and when they were building things. But now it's broadening into affecting other areas, and other ones of our members have had to address these types of claims as well. So we believe that this compromise protects the foundation that we laid in 1990 to allow that and ensure that it will continue forward. And the bill is a compromise on those issues.
I think you tell your mill workers that...
I'm in pretty good shape with them.
Okay. Well, they're going to have a fairer system.
Yeah.
That they're going to have more voice in how the claims are handled. They're going to have better medical treatment, and it will solve some of the problems again that have nagged the system for a long time.
One last thing is this provides some predictability, which is kind of the point on the new and omitted conditions, because right now the predictability isn't there. So to the extent that you're better off knowing what your exposures are going to be, and we believe this bill sets some parameters that don't exist currently.
I guess the fairness issue would may cost us a point or two, but it's a fairness issue that's probably going to bubble to the top as we go through the discussions.
And we're looking from the estimates that have been given, and there'll be others, I'm sure, but you look at what has been presented before the MLAC committee of anywhere from less than 1% up to right now 2%, but the one with the 2%, clearly had qualified that they hadn't considered the administrative impacts. But that's out of a $600 million system. And so...
Mr. Chair,
Senator Corbin was up next. Well, Mr. Chair, the major contributing factor in the pre-existing conditions are of great concern to me, and I'm just hoping, from a process standpoint, that we bring in as witnesses some medical expertise on these notions, so that we can be clear about them. Because in my job, we don't do workers' comp claims in my union. We turf them out to attorneys, and so I don't have much knowledge of the workers' comp system, but I do know what I hear from workers anecdotally about their treatment system, and I just hope that we get some medical expertise in here that can pretty specifically delve into these issues of the kind of surety that the medical providers have on questions of major contributing cause and pre-existing conditions.
Well, everyone certainly has an opportunity and for another hour and a half or so today, and then on Friday. So.
Well, that's not my point, Mr. Chair. My point is I think that we should, as a committee, solicit that kind of expert testimony and not just wait for whoever comes through the door. That's my point.
Well, I guess we will take that into advisement, and we'll see what happens after we get through Friday's testimony, where we are from there. Senator Deckard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just on Senator Harper's point, Lisa, how do you respond to the concern that I've at least heard that a point and a point and a half is not, the concern is that it could be a great deal more than that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckard, the numbers are calculated by people that do these calculations, and it's not something that we put together. So I guess that it's like anything else. When you get dueling experts, it's whose expert are you most comfortable with?
Could I answer that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Decker, you raise a great question, and I'm glad you did. At our meeting last week, we had three fiscal analyses. One was by the National Council on Compensation Insurance. We call it NCCI. They are a national rating bureau for workers' compensation that rates workers' comp in, I believe, last I heard, 34 states, including Oregon. We also had a fiscal impact from the workers' comp department. We also had a fiscal impact from Safe Corporation. We had three fiscal impacts all within a point of each other. We couldn't do that kind of accuracy on polling elections. Particularly in Florida, and I just want to stress, I've done a lot of this, and that is not a phantom number. That's not fuzzy math. That's really good numbers that this committee should feel very comfortable with. So I'm glad you raised that issue.
I think we're gonna have other people coming up very soon, and we'll try to give us some different numbers, or right. Not only try to, they will give us a different perspective on the issue. So, any further questions of these three? Thank you very much for bringing this forward, I think.
We will stand for about a, let's say, 7-minute recess, and then we're back. And when we come back, we will have, and I'm going to butcher these names. How about I go this way? Jennifer, your group will be up first when we come back. We're recessed.